You're listening to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and with me today in the studio is Darren Cox. He's vice president for the American Honey Producers Association and also president of Cox Honey in Logan. And we're talking today about mosquito abatement districts and in particular how they might affect what you're doing with beekeeping. And you certainly have not only for a Utah perspective, but a national perspective being vice president with the Honey Producers Association. So I guess the first question is, tell me what you think about mosquito abatement districts.
You know, it is a public health concern. So the Center of Disease Control and other health agencies through the United States have came together and they want to try to control West Nile virus. When we look at trying to control something like mosquitoes, I don't think there's any way we're ever going to be able to get rid of all the mosquitoes. So they're trying to mitigate population controls through their efforts. It's my opinion that when we try to do these mitigation efforts, that there's a lot of best management practices that could be done to try to keep the populations down. And a chemical solution should be the very, very last solution that we use. There's many different natural ways of controlling mosquitoes, whether it's going to be building bird boxes that eat mosquitoes or having dragonfly nests or even using the late Dr. Ross Nilsson's work to where it was a form of decreased fitness. I can tell you that the cotton industry used that as one of their key products to get rid of the pink bollworm. And it was through irradiating that for 11 generations out that they would irradiate the males. And then when they mated with the general population, it would cause decreased fitness and it would wipe the species out.
Mm. So as far as how most mosquito abatement districts are set up, mm-hmm. Are most of them spraying, is it a fogging, or are they doing more of a larvicide, just treating specific areas, or does it just change from one to the next?
I think they do the two-prong approach. I think they do the larvicide in your waters, and I also think that they do the fogging.
And from your perspective as a beekeeper, how does that affect what you do? Is there much in the way of residuals that affect the bees the next day?
The residuals is really, really unknown on many of these products because we have improper testing that was done by the EPA when these products came onto market. These products were only tested under a LD50 scale to where...
And what is an LD50 scale?
An LD50 scale represents the amount of lethality a product has within a 48-hour period. If it would kill at least, say, 50% of the test subjects.
Sounds quite high.
Yes. Now, Europe, I believe Europe is way ahead of us in this. They have came out with multi-tiered testing. They want to be able to test if it affects the reproductive part of the specimens or the memory loss or the lifespan or even if it makes them become lethargic. So they're really pulling a rake through it to try to understand chronic effects and unknown effects through their testings.
If the fogging is going on at night, we don't know how that affects bees the next day. I mean, I've heard that supposedly once it's on contact, there's not an issue. But what I'm hearing you say is we really don't know.
We really don't know as far as there's many different aspects you can look at it. You can look at it as we don't know what the full effect is going to be on the non-targets. We don't know what the full effects are going to be on honeybees as far as long-term chronic effects. If it could affect their memory, navigation, honey production, if it could affect their reproductive parts to where they become sterile, we really don't know that. When we're applying these products on at night, it's unknown. Also, if they're using a surfactant like diesel fuel to allow it to carry further from what they may have as an intended target. We don't know if it gets out into people's yards and on their lawns for the stickers and adjuvants that go into these products. If it gets carried into people's homes on the carpet, or if windows are open, if it comes inside, then what is the breakdown of these products inside of a dwelling versus outside of a dwelling on the grass? These are unknowns.
So why does it seem that Europe always seems to be one or two steps ahead of the U.S.?
I can't answer that question. I can tell you that the bee industry put together the Pelston Conference, and we pulled researchers in from around the world and put the best scientists together and was trying to figure out protocols for doing the testing, multi-tier testing. And we came together, and it kept getting filtered, and now that it's been completed, we still haven't got that put in place to where we were requiring multi-tier testing and life cycle testing on non-targets or targets.
Just again, from your perspective, do you see mosquito abatement spraying as being a positive or negative, or you're just not quite sure what side you come down on yet?
I think you have to have a balance in all things. There certainly is best management practices that could be implemented by the mosquito abatements. Understanding sensitive areas. There's understanding wind speeds when wind speeds are prohibitive. Understanding man hours, or you know, are these individuals, is this their regular 40-hour week, or we ask them to work overtime? Anytime you get into extra labor hours on individual, you just like Highway Safety Transportation Act, we start reducing the amount of hours that these truck drivers are able to drive, and you start reducing the amount of mistakes and accidents. There's been talk within the bee industry of trying to make all usage reporting mandatory. We believe that everybody has the right to know who sprays what, where, when, and why in our communities, so that we can be able to identify, is there a way that it is working, or is there a way that it's not working? Certainly when you get into doing fogging and products versus the larvicides, it's a whole different mechanism, because it's a moving target instead of a singular target, to where there's a pond instead of a truck driving down a road. There's been talk of trying to come up with updated equipment that would have a barcode that would scan the product on and have GPS overlap mappings of the areas for sensitive and non-sensitive areas that would automatically alert the driver if the wind speed was too high, if they were too close to a sensitive target, or a target to where the citizens or landowners didn't want them to spray, or if they were too close to, say, a bird refuge or a school. And, you know, another part of that is if they can spray at night and doing their fogging at night, you're going to have less people, you know, out during their walks and around their communities and neighborhood. And the bees are done flying. So that's really, really the best time to apply it, if we're going to apply it.
However, my concern would be, okay, I'm assuming you work with the abatement districts to make sure that you don't have hives in an area where they're going to be fogging. What about for the average homeowner? I mean, if I've got bees, a hive of bees in my backyard, I still don't want to have that chemical. I mean, I can smell it when it comes into the house, and we run around and try to close all the windows when we hear the truck going around. I don't want that going into the hive. How do you mitigate that?
I think the best way you can try to mitigate it, it's difficult when you have managed pollinators versus native pollinators. There's nobody from the native pollinators to say, you just wiped out my home and my nest. That's why my position is spraying should absolutely be an emergency, and it should be the last effort that is made.
So it shouldn't be done every single week doing it?
It shouldn't be done in my opinion, it should not be done every single week. We should have thresholds developed to where we can understand our population dynamics, and when populations hit a certain point, whether it be West Nile infections or what they're trying to control, then we authorize spraying. Not just it's that time of the week and it's that time of the day. It doesn't matter if the wind's blowing or not, you know. We certainly need to have our checks and balances.
I think sometimes I've heard the concern as well. The mosquito abatement district is set up. There's money there, so as long as there's money, we'll just do it.
Yeah, that's that's problematic. There's citizens out there that want it, and there's citizens out there that don't want it. And certainly by having a mapping and a timed route to where the landowners would be aware that, you know, at 10:45 on this particular night, they know that the truck's going to come past. And if there is a computer built-in program into the trucks that automatically shut off by the property owner's request, that would take care of the problem.
Do you opt out of the spraying in the areas where your hives are?
No, where I run my locations, I've got locations throughout northern Utah, Idaho, Wyoming, California. I'm even into North Dakota.
So
now,
you're not only having to worry about Cache Valley, you're having to worry about everywhere you've got your hives.
Right, and when you've got,
and the regulations are different from one to the next,
and they'll change from different states. When you've got over 100 locations like me, and trying to mitigate, you've got a bee yard with a 3-mile radius, and you've got wind speeds. That's why we have the label. The label dictates when it's safe to apply. If the wind's blowing, they're not supposed to apply it. Not just because it's that time of the night, it means that it's unsafe to use.
Do you think, for the most part, that they're being as strict as they should be about that?
I think they've gotten better. You know, back when West Nile first hit, we had a really major incident in the west side of Logan to where there was an aerial spraying done. And it was done during daylight hours over the top of two stockyards, and over 1,000 hives of bees was severely damaged. I think they are becoming more and more aware that there is not just honeybees but managed pollinators in the area. But I think that we need to sit down at the drawing board and relook at things and figure out, okay, how can we do it better if we have to do it? And do we really, really have to do it?
Have you seen, do you think it contributes at all to the colony collapse?
I think
to the overall health of the bee industry.
The overall health of the bee industry, we're finding an average of almost 7 different insecticides in every pollen sample that was done at Penn State. Colony collapse disorder, for quite a period of time, we always viewed it as multifactorial. We had the importation of the Australian package bees that came in. We thought we were like mixing smallpox and Indians, smallpox and viruses like that. Because the Australian bees had viruses and that would never had before in our bees, and our bees never seen that. So, but usually after you have a pandemic like that, within a 4-year time frame, it cycles out, and it has not cycled out. Hmm. So now we're starting to take a harder look at some of these pesticide products that are out there that are systemic in nature.
So if it's in the pollen, does that mean that it's also in the honey?
Not necessarily. It depends on if it's a oil base or a product that can be transferred into the honey. I know a lot of your major honey packers all screen for pesticides in the honey.
And are you so they're looking right now, like with the Penn State, can they track, well, okay, this chemical came in through mosquito abatement districts, for instance. Could they do it that way?
They may be able to do that way, but I have not heard of that kind of data. They're just talking about general pesticide findings that they found. And in fact, even in the umbilical cord between the mother and the child now, we're finding products that shouldn't be there.
Okay. Well, it sounds like there's a lot more work that needs to be done. Hopefully we'll proceed more cautiously in the future because our food supply depends on it.
Well, our food supply depends on it. Our next generation would like to be able to have the same kind of environmental friendly ecosystem that we may have enjoyed as a child. But, you know, things are changing. It's a difficult position for the commercial beekeeper because we basically live on the good graces of farmers in our community in order to have rental places to put our bees. And there's a very large polarized match going on right now. We've got the pesticide and chem industry and your ag community on one side. On the other side, we've got a lot of your environmental groups, and the bee industry is really stuck in the middle. Mm. And we're just trying to do the best thing we can to survive, but we certainly would like to see increased funding for our ARS research labs. We'd like to see more funding come from the President Obama's initiatives on our 2015 Farm Bill that just came through. But the pesticides that are here on the market, we'd like to see them start back screening and finding out what is the chronic effects of these products that may be having on our beehives.
Now, you have seen chemicals being taken off the market. I mean, diazinon used to be completely available, and it's gone. Do you see that continuing where they're tightening up those regulations finally so that products that are a little more pervasive and affect the environment more are being taken off?
As I see a lot of these products, some products can stay on the market for a longer period of time because they're not known to have serious health problems to humans like organophosphates. Your DDTs, when it was pulled off, we started seeing that residuals in our fats and in the mammals. The problem is a lot of these products are brought into the market under a Section 18, which is an emergency exemption, so all the testing hasn't been done.
So why is it an emergency?
It's always an emergency when you have crops that humans depend upon for food that are being destroyed by pests. And on the average, and I learned this on the PPDC, on average in the United States, we have 2 new pest species every week coming into the United States. So the farmers are really, really, really being challenged on how to protect their crops. And the beekeepers are being challenged by trying to keep their bees alive. And the chem companies, they want to be able to still be able to come out with effective controls in order to safeguard our food. And it takes a lot of extra money to do the kind of testing that Europe is requiring now. You know, there's a lot of talk in the news about the neonicotinoids and that they may be implicated in the bee health decline. I know Harvard just this week just released a study that kind of points to that direction. As I understand, it's well known that organochlorine pesticides have been banned as a group because of their inert toxicity to many forms of life and their bioaccumulative properties. That's one thing we got to worry about is if they're going to bioaccumulate.
Kind of like what DDT.
Exactly like DDT, and they had that long persistence. That's why we can still find DDT today. The scary thing about that is, you know, the neonicotinoid, as I understand, is a new organochlorine pesticide that is from the same family of banned organochlorine, such as aldrin, dieldrin, and DDT. Hmm. So just because you change the patent doesn't mean you change the effect.
And it sounds like, again, you're stuck right in the middle.
Beekeepers are stuck right in the middle. We're farmers. You know, we've got mites in our bees. We've got to be able to kill a bug on a bug. And we have to survive. At the end of the day, you know, on our PPDC work groups, we've got the bee industry is front, there, and center. We've got four different work groups that's heavily involved. We're traveling to the honey producers. We're sending people there half a dozen times a year trying to find out where can we find the balance. And a lot of it is improving management practices.
Mm. Well, Darren, we've run out of time. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate doing it. You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. Darren Cox is vice president for the American Honey Producers Association and also president of Cox Honey in Logan. And stay tuned. Coming up next is a conversation with Ron Hellstern on the monarch butterfly.